This is Audible.
Audible presents this brilliance audio production of
The Black Echo by Michael Connelly. Copyright 1992 by Michael Connelly and performance copyright 1998 by Brilliance Corporation. All rights reserved. The Black Echo. This is for W. Michael Connelly and Mary McAvoy Connelly. I would like to thank the following people for their help and support. Many thanks to my agent, Philip Spitzer, and to my editor, Patricia Mulcahy, for all their hard work, enthusiasm, and belief in this book. Also, thanks to the many police officers who over the years have given me an insight into their jobs and lives. I also want to acknowledge Tom Mangold and John Pennicate, whose book, The Tunnels of Cu Chi, tells the real story of the tunnel rats of the Vietnam War. Last, I would like to thank my family and friends for their encouragement and unqualified support. And most of all, I am indebted to my wife, Linda, whose belief and inspiration never waned. Part 1. Sunday, May 20th. The boy couldn't see in the dark, but he didn't need to. Experience and long practice told him it was good, nice and even. Smooth strokes, moving his whole arm while gently rolling his wrist. Keep the marble moving. No runs. Beautiful. He heard the hiss of the escaping air and could sense the roll of the marble. They were sensations that were comforting to him. The smell reminded him of the sock in his pocket, and he thought about getting high. Maybe after, he decided. He didn't want to stop now, not until he had finished the tag with one uninterrupted stroke. But then he stopped, when the sound of an engine was heard above the hiss of the spray can. He looked around but saw no light, save for the moon's silvery white reflection on the reservoir and the dim bulb above the door of the pump house, which was midway across the dam. But the sound didn't lie. There was an engine approaching. It sounded like a truck to the boy, and now he thought he could hear the crunching of tires on the gravel access road that skirted the reservoir. Coming closer. Almost 3 a.m. and someone was coming. Why? The boy stood up and threw the aerosol can over the fence toward the water. He heard it clunk down in the brush, short of the mark. He pulled a sock from his pocket and decided just one quick blow to give himself balls. He buried his nose in the sock and drew in heavily on the paint fumes. He rocked back on his heels, and his eyelids fluttered involuntarily. He threw the sock over the fence. The boy stood his motorbike up and wheeled it across the road, back toward the tall grass and the bottle brush and pine trees at the base of the hill. It was good cover, he thought, and he'd be able to see what was coming. The sound of the engine was louder now. He was sure it was just a few seconds away, but he didn't see the glow of headlights. This confused him. But it was too late to run. He put the motorbike down in the tall brown grass and stilled the free-spinning front wheel with his hand. Then he huddled down on the earth and waited for whatever and whoever was coming. Harry Bosch could hear the helicopter up there, somewhere above the darkness, circling up in the light. Why didn't it land? Why didn't it bring help? Harry was moving through a smoky, dark tunnel and his batteries were dying. The beam of the flashlight grew weaker every yard he covered. He needed help. He needed to move faster. He needed to reach the end of the tunnel before the light was gone and he was alone in the black. He heard the chopper make one more pass. Why didn't it land? Where was the help he needed? When the drone of the blades fluttered away again, he felt the terror build, and he moved faster, crawling on scraped and bloody knees, one hand holding the dim light up, the other pawing the ground to keep his balance. He did not look back, for he knew the enemy was behind him in the black mist, unseen but there, and closing in. When the phone rang in the kitchen, Bosch immediately woke. He counted the rings, wondering if he had missed the first one or two, wondering if he had left the answering machine on. He hadn't. The call was not picked up, and the ringing didn't stop until the required 8 rounds. He absent-mindedly wondered where that tradition had come from. Why not 6 rings? Why not 10? He rubbed his eyes and looked around. He was slumped in the living room chair again, the soft recliner that was the centerpiece of his meager furnishings. He thought of it as his watch chair. This was a misnomer, however, because he slept in the chair often, even when he wasn't on call. Morning light cut through the crack in the curtains and slashed its mark across the bleached pine floor. He watched particles of dust floating lazily in the light near the sliding glass door. The lamp on the table next to him was on, and the TV against the wall, its sound very low, was broadcasting a Sunday morning Jesus show. On the table next to the chair were the companions of insomnia, playing cards, magazines, and paperback mystery novels, these only lightly thumbed and then discarded. There was a crumpled pack of cigarettes on the table and three empty beer bottles, assorted brands that had once been members of six packs of their own tribe. Bosch was fully dressed, right down to a rumpled tie held to his white shirt by a silver 187 tie tack. He reached his hand down to his belt and then around to the area below his kidney. He waited. When the electronic pager sounded, he cut the annoying chirp off in a second. He pulled the device off his belt and looked at the number. He wasn't surprised. He pushed himself out of the chair, stretched, and popped the joints of his neck and back. He walked to the kitchen where the phone was on the counter. He wrote, Sunday, 8:53 a.m., in a notebook he took from his jacket pocket before dialing. After two rings, a voice said,
Los Angeles Police Department, Hollywood Division, this is Officer Pelch. How can I help you?
Bosch said, Somebody could die in the time it took to get all that out. Let me talk to the watch sergeant. Bosch found a fresh pack of cigarettes in a kitchen cabinet and got his first smoke of the day going. He rinsed dust out of a glass and filled it with tap water, then took two aspirins out of a plastic bottle that was also in the cabinet. He was swallowing the second when a sergeant named Crowley finally picked up.
What, a kitchen church? I rang your house, no answer.
Crowley, what have you got for me?
Well, I know we had you out last night on that TV thing, but you're still catching, you and your partner, all weekend. So that means you got the DB up at Lake Hollywood, in a pipe up there. It's on the access road to the Mulholland Dam, you know it?
I know the place. What else?
Patrol's out, ME, Sid notified. My people don't know what they got except the DB. Stiff's about 30 feet into this pipe there. They don't want to go all the way in, mess up a possible crime scene, you know. I had him page your partner, but he hasn't called in. No answer at his phone, either. I thought maybe the two of you was together or something. Then I thought, nah, he ain't your style, and you ain't his.
I'll get a hold of him. If they didn't go all the way in, how do they know it's a DB and not just some guy sleeping it off?
Well, they went in a bit, you know, and reached in with a stick or something and poked around at the guy pretty good. Stiff as a wedding night prick.
They didn't want to mess up a crime scene, but then they go poking around the body with a stick. That's wonderful. These guys get in after they raise the college requirement, or what?
Hey, Bosch, we get a call, we've got to check it out, okay? You want for us to transfer all our body calls directly to the homicide table to check out? You guys go nuts inside a week.
Bosch crushed the cigarette butt in the stainless steel sink and looked out the kitchen window. Looking down the hill, he could see one of the tourist trams moving between the huge, beige sound studios in Universal City. A side of one of the block-long buildings was painted sky blue with wisps of white clouds for filming exteriors when the natural L.A. exterior turned brown as wheat. Bosch said, How'd we get the call?
Anonymous to 911. A little after 0400, dispatcher said it came from a payphone on the boulevard. Somebody out screwing around found the thing in the pipe. Wouldn't give a name. Said there was a stiff in the pipe, that's all. They'll have the tape down at the comm center.
Bosch felt himself getting angry. He pulled a bottle of aspirin out of the cabinet and put it in his pocket. While thinking about the 0400 call, he opened the refrigerator and bent in. He saw nothing that interested him. He looked at his watch.
Crowley, if the report came in at 4 a.m., why are you just getting to me now, nearly 5 hours later?
Look, Bosch, all we had was an anonymous call. That's it. Dispatcher said it was a kid, no less. I wasn't going to send one of my guys up that pipe in the middle of the night on information like that. Could have been a prank, could have been an ambush, could have been anything, for Christ's sake. I waited till it got light out and things slowed down around here. Sent some of my guys over there at the end of the shift. Speaking of end of shifts, I'm out of here. I've been waiting to hear from them and from you. Anything else?
Bosch felt like asking if it ever occurred to him that it would be dark in the pipe, whether they went poking around at 0400 or 0800. But let it go. What was the use?
Anything else?
Crowley said again. Bosch couldn't think of anything, but Crowley filled the empty space.
It's probably just some hype who croaked himself, Harry. No righteous 187 case. Happens all the time. Hell, you remember we pulled one out of that same pipe last year. Well, that was before you came out to Hollywood. So see, what I'm saying is some guy, he goes into this same pipe. These transients, they sleep up there all the time. And he's a slammer, but he shoots himself with a hot load and that's it. Checks out. Except we didn't find him so fast that time, and with his son and all beaten on the pipe a couple days, he gets cooked in there, roasted like a tom turkey. But it didn't smell as good.
Crowley laughed at his own joke. Bosch didn't. The watch sergeant continued.
When we pulled this guy out, the spike was still in his arm. Same thing here, just a bullshit job, a no-count case. You go out there, you'll be back home by noon, take a nap, maybe go catch the Dodgers. And then next weekend, somebody else's turn in the barrel. You're off watch. And that's a 3-day pass. You got Memorial Day weekend coming next week. So do me a favor. Just go out and see what they've got.
Bosch thought a moment and was about to hang up, then said, Crowley, what did you mean you didn't find that other one so fast? What makes you think we found this one fast?
My guys out there, they say they can't smell a thing off this stiff, other than a little piss. Must be fresh.
Tell your guys I'll be there in 15 minutes. Tell them not to fuck anymore with anything at my scene.
Bosch knew Crowley was going to defend his men again, but hung up before he had to hear it. He lit another cigarette as he went to the front door to get the Times off the step. He spread the 12 pounds of Sunday paper out on the kitchen counter, wondering how many trees died. He found the real estate supplement and paged through it until he saw a large display ad for Valley Pride Properties. He ran his finger down a list of open houses until he found one address and description marked Cole Jerry. He dialed the number.
Valley Pride Properties, can I help you?
Jerry Edgar, please.
A few seconds passed, and Bosch heard a couple of transfer clicks before his partner got on the line.
This is Jerry. May I help you?
Jed, we just got another call. Up at the Mulholland Dam. And you aren't wearing your pager.
Shit,
Edgar said, and there was silence. Bosch could almost hear him thinking, I've got 3 showings today. There was more silence, and Bosch pictured his partner on the other end of the line in a $900 suit and a bankrupt frown.
What's the call?
Bosch told him what little he knew.
If you want me to take this one solo, I will, Bosch said. If anything comes up with 98, I'll be able to cover it. I'll tell him you're taking the TV thing and I'm doing the stiff in the pipe.
Yeah, I know you would, but it's okay. I'm on my way. I'm just going to have to find someone to cover for my ass first.
They agreed to meet at the body, and Bosch hung up. He turned the answering machine on, took 2 packs of cigarettes from the cabinet and put them in his sport coat pocket. He reached into another cabinet and took out the nylon holster that held his gun, a Smith & Wesson 9mm, satin-finished stainless steel, and loaded with 8 rounds of XTPs. Bosch thought about the ad he had seen once in a police magazine. Extreme terminal performance. A bullet that expanded on impact to 1.5 times its width, reaching terminal depth in the body and leaving maximum wound channels. Whoever had written it had been right. Bosch had killed a man a year earlier with 1 shot from 20 feet. Went in under the right armpit, exited below the left nipple, shattering heart and lungs on its way. XTP. Maximum wound channels. He clipped the holster to his belt on the right side so he could reach across his body and take it with his left hand. He went into the bathroom and brushed his teeth without toothpaste. He was out and had forgotten to go by the store. He dragged a wet comb through his hair and stared at his red-rimmed 40-year-old eyes for a long moment. Then he studied the gray hairs that were steadily crowding out the brown in his curly hair. Even the mustache was going gray. He had begun seeing flecks of gray in the sink when he shaved. He touched a hand to his chin, but decided not to shave. He left his house then without changing even his tie. He knew his client wouldn't mind. Bosch found a space where there were no pigeon droppings and leaned his elbows on the railing that ran along the top of the Mulholland Dam. A cigarette dangled from his lips, and he looked through the cleft of the hills to the city below. The sky was gunpowder gray, and the smog was a form-fitted shroud over Hollywood. A few of the far-off towers in downtown poked up through the poison, but the rest of the city was under the blanket. It looked like a ghost town. There was a slight chemical odor on the warm breeze, and after a while he pegged it. Malathion.
He'd heard on the radio that the fruit fly helicopters had been up the night before, spraying North Hollywood down through the Cahuenga Pass. He thought of his dream and remembered the chopper that did not land. To his back was the blue-green expanse of the Hollywood Reservoir, 60 million gallons of the city's drinking water trapped by the venerable old dam in a canyon between two of the Hollywood hills. A 6-foot band of dried clay ran the length of the shoreline, a reminder that L.A. was in its 4th year of drought. Farther up the reservoir bank was a 10-foot-high chain-link fence that girded the entire shoreline. Bosch had studied this barrier when he first arrived, and wondered if the protection was for the people on one side of the fence or the water on the other. Bosch was wearing a blue jumpsuit over his rumpled suit. His sweat had stained through the underarms and back of both layers of clothing. His hair was damp and his mustache drooped. He had been inside the pipe. He could feel the slight, warm tickle of a Santa Ana wind drying the sweat on the back of his neck. They had come early this year. Harry was not a big man. He stood a few inches short of 6 feet and was built lean. The newspapers, when they described him, called him wiry. Beneath the jumpsuit, his muscles were like nylon cords, strength concealed by economy of size. The gray that flecked his hair was more partial to the left side. His eyes were brown-black and seldom betrayed emotion or intention. The pipe was located above ground and ran for 50 yards alongside the reservoir's access road. It was rusted inside and out, and was empty and unused except by those who sought its interior as a shelter or its exterior as a canvas for spray paint. Bosch had had no clue to its purpose until the reservoir caretaker had volunteered the information. The pipe was a mud break. Heavy rain, the caretaker said, could loosen earth and send mud sliding off the hillsides and into the reservoir. The 3-foot-wide pipe, left over from some unknown district project or boondoggle, had been placed in a predicted slide area as the reservoir's first and only defense. The pipe was held in place by 1/2-inch-thick iron rebar that looped over it and was embedded in concrete below. Bosch had put on the jumpsuit before going into the pipe. The letters LAPD were printed in white across the back. After taking it out of the trunk of his car and stepping into it, he realized it was probably cleaner than the suit he was trying to protect. But he wore it anyway because he had always worn it. He was a methodical, traditional, superstitious detective. As he had crawled with flashlight in hand into the damp-smelling, claustrophobic cylinder, he felt his throat tighten and his heartbeat quicken. A familiar emptiness in his gut gripped him. Fear. But he snapped on the light, and the darkness receded along with the uneasy feelings, and he set about his work. Now he stood on the dam and smoked, and thought about things. Crowley, the watch sergeant, had been right. The man in the pipe was certainly dead. But he had also been wrong. This would not be an easy one. Harry would not be home in time for an afternoon nap or to listen to the Dodgers on KABC. Things were wrong here. Harry wasn't 10 feet inside the pipe before he knew that. There were no tracks in the pipe. Or rather, there were no tracks that were of use. The bottom of the pipe was dusty with dried orange mud and cluttered with paper bags, empty wine bottles, cotton balls, used syringes, newspaper bedding, the debris of the homeless and addicted. Bosch had studied it all in the beam of the flashlight as he slowly made his way toward the body, and he had found no clear trail left by the dead man, who lay head first into the pipe. This was not right. If the dead man had crawled in of his own accord, there would be some indication of this. If he had been dragged in, there would be some sign of that, too, but there was nothing. And this deficiency was only the first of the things that troubled Bosch. When he reached the body, he found the dead man's shirt, a black, open-collar crew shirt, pulled up over his head with his arms tangled inside. Bosch had seen enough dead people to know that literally nothing was impossible during the last breaths. He had worked a suicide in which a man who had shot himself in the head had then changed pants before dying, apparently because he did not want his body to be discovered, soaked in human waste. But the shirt and the arms on the dead man in the pipe did not seem acceptable to Harry. It looked to Bosch as if the body had been dragged into the pipe by someone who had pulled the dead man by the collar. Bosch had not disturbed the body or pulled the shirt away from the face. He noted that it was a white male. He detected no immediate indication of the fatal injury. After finishing his survey of the body, Bosch carefully moved over the corpse, his face coming within a half foot of it, and then continued through the pipe's remaining 40 yards. He found no tracks and nothing else of evidentiary value. In 20 minutes, he was back in the sunlight. He then sent a crime scene tech named Donovan in to chart the location of debris in the pipe and video the body in place. Donovan's face had betrayed his surprise at having to go into the pipe on a case he'd already written off as an OD. He had tickets to the Dodgers, Bosch figured. After leaving the pipe to Donovan, Bosch had lit a cigarette and walked to the dam's railing to look down on the fouled city and brood. At the railing, he could hear the sound of traffic filtering up from the Hollywood freeway. It almost sounded gentle from such a distance, like a calm ocean. Down through the cleft of the canyon, he saw blue swimming pools and Spanish tile roofs. A woman in a white tank top and lime green jogging shorts ran by him on the dam. A compact radio was clipped to her waistband, and a thin yellow wire carried sound to the earphones clamped to her head. She seemed to be in her own world, unaware of the grouping of police ahead of her, until she reached the yellow crime scene tape stretched across the end of the dam. It told her to stop in two languages. She jogged in place for a few moments, her long blonde hair clinging to sweat on her shoulders, and watched the police, who were mostly watching her. Then she turned and headed back past Bosch. His eyes followed her, and he noticed that when she went by the pump house, she deviated her course to avoid something. He walked over and found glass on the pavement. He looked up and saw the broken bulb in the socket above the pump house door. He made a mental note to ask the caretaker if the bulb had been checked lately. When Bosch returned to his spot at the railing, a blur of movement from below drew his attention. He looked down and saw a coyote sniffing among the pine needles and trash that covered the earth below the trees in front of the dam. The animal was small, and its coat was scruffy and completely missing some patches of hair. There were only a few of them left in the city's protected areas, left to scavenge among the debris of the human scavengers.
"They're pulling it out now,"
a voice said from behind. Bosch turned and saw one of the uniforms that had been assigned to the crime scene. He nodded and followed him off the dam, under the yellow tape and back to the pipe. A cacophony of grunts and heavy gasps echoed from the mouth of the graffiti-scarred pipe. A shirtless man, with his heavily muscled back scratched and dirty, emerged backward, towing a sheet of heavy, black plastic on top of which lay the body. The dead man was still face up, with his head and arms mostly obscured in the wrapping of the black shirt. Bosch looked around for Donovan and saw him stowing a video recorder in the back of the blue crime scene van. Harry walked over.
"Now I'm going to need you to go back in. All the debris in there. Newspapers, cans, bags. I saw some hypos, cotton bottles. I need it all bagged."
"You got it,"
Donovan said.
He waited a beat and added, "I'm not saying anything, but Harry, you really think this is the real thing? Is it worth busting our balls on?"
"I guess we won't know until after the cut." He started to walk away but stopped.
"Look, Donnie, I know it's Sunday, and thanks for going back in."
"No problem. It's straight OT for me."
The shirtless man and a coroner's technician were sitting on their haunches, huddled over the body. They both wore white rubber gloves. The technician was Larry Sakai, a guy Bosch had known for years, but never liked. He had a plastic fishing tackle box open on the ground next to him. He took a scalpel from the box and made a 1-inch-long cut into the side of the body, just above the left hip. No blood came from the slice. From the box, he then removed a thermometer and attached it to the end of a curved probe. He stuck it into the incision, expertly though roughly turning it and driving it up into the liver. The shirtless man grimaced, and Bosch noticed he had a blue tear tattooed at the outside corner of his right eye. It somehow seemed appropriate to Bosch. It was the most sympathy the dead man would get here.
"Time of death is going to be a pisser," Sakai said.
He did not look up from his work.
"That pipe, you know, with the heat rising, it's going to skew the temperature loss in the liver. Aceto took a reading in there and it was 81. 10 minutes later it was 83. We don't have a fixed temp in the body or the pipe."
"So?" Bosch said.
So, I am not giving you anything here. I gotta take it back and do some calculating.
You mean give it to somebody else who knows how to figure it? Bosch said.
You'll get it when you come in for the autopsy. Don't worry, man.
Speaking of which, who's doing the cutting today? Sakai didn't answer. He was busy with the dead man's legs. He grabbed each shoe and manipulated the ankles. He moved his hands up the legs and reached beneath the thighs, lifting each leg and watching as it bent at the knee. He then pressed his hands down on the abdomen as if feeling for contraband. Lastly, he reached inside the shirt and tried to turn the dead man's head. It didn't move. Bosch knew rigor mortis worked its way from the head through the body and then into the extremities.
This guy's neck is locked, but good, Sakai said. Stomach's getting there, but the extremities still have good movement.
He took a pencil from behind his ear and pressed the eraser end against the skin on the side of the torso. There was purplish blotching on the half of the body closest to the ground, as if the body were half full of red wine. It was post-mortem lividity. When the heart stops pumping, the blood seeks the low ground. When Sakai pressed the pencil against the dark skin, it did not blanch white, a sign the blood had fully clotted. The man had been dead for hours.
The pulmonary lividity is steady, Sakai said. That and the rig makes me estimate that this dude's been dead maybe 6 to 8 hours. That's going to have to hold you, Bosch, until we can work with the temps.
Sakai didn't look up as he said this. He and the one called Osito began pulling the pockets on the dead man's green fatigue pants inside out. They were empty, as were the large baggy pockets on the thighs. They rolled the body to one side to check the back pockets. As they did this, Bosch leaned down to look closely at the exposed back of the dead man. The skin was purplish with lividity and dirty, but he saw no scratches or marks that allowed him to conclude that the body had been dragged.
Nothing in the pants, Bosch, no ID, Sakai said, still not looking up.
Then they began to gently pull the black shirt back over the head and onto the torso. The dead man had straggly hair that had more gray in it than the original black. His beard was unkempt and he looked to be about 50, which made Bosch figure him at about 40. There was something in the breast pocket of the shirt and Sakai fished it out, looked at it a moment, and then put it into a plastic bag held open by his partner.
Bingo, Sakai said and handed the bag up to Bosch. One set of works makes our jobs all a lot easier.
Sakai next peeled the dead man's cracked eyelids all the way open. The eyes were blue, with a milky caul over them. Each pupil was constricted to about the size of a pencil lead. They stared vacantly up at Bosch, each pupil a small black void. Sakai made some notes on a clipboard. He'd made his decision on this one. Then he pulled an ink pad and a print card from the tackle box by his side. He inked the fingers of the left hand and began pressing them on the card. Bosch admired how quickly and expertly he did this. But then Sakai stopped.
Hey, check it out.
Sakai gently moved the index finger. It was easily manipulated in any direction. The joint was cleanly broken, but there was no sign of swelling or hemorrhage.
It looks post to me, Sakai said.
Bosch stooped to look closer. He took the dead man's hand away from Sakai and felt it with both his own, ungloved hands. He looked at Sakai and then at Osito.
Bosch, don't start in, Sakai barked. Don't be looking at him. He knows better. I trained him myself.
Bosch didn't remind Sakai that it was he who had been driving the ME wagon that dumped the body strapped to a wheeled stretcher onto the Ventura freeway a few months back, during rush hour. The stretcher rolled down the Lancashire Boulevard exit and hit the back end of a car at a gas station. Because of the fiberglass partition in the cab, Sakai didn't know he had lost the body until he arrived at the morgue. Bosch handed the dead man's hand back to the coroner's tech. Sakai turned to Osito and spoke a question in Spanish. Osito's small, brown face became very serious, and he shook his head no.
He didn't even touch the guy's hands in there, so you better wait until the cut before you go saying something you aren't sure about.
Sakai finished transferring the fingerprints and then handed the card to Bosch.
Bag the hands, Bosch said to him, though he didn't need to.
And the feet. He stood back up and began waving the card to get the ink to dry. With his other hand, he held up the plastic evidence bag Sakai had given him. In it, a rubber band held together a hypodermic needle, a small vial that was half filled with what looked like dirty water,
a wad of cotton, and a pack of matches. It was a shooter's kit, and it looked fairly new. The spike was clean with no sign of corrosion. The cotton, Bosch guessed, had only been used as a strainer once or twice. There were tiny, whitish-brown crystals in the fibers. By turning the bag, he could look inside each side of the matchbook and see only two matches missing. Donovan crawled out of the pipe at that moment. He was wearing a miner's helmet equipped with a flashlight. In one hand, he carried several plastic bags, each containing a yellowed newspaper or a food wrapper or a crushed beer can. In the other, he carried a clipboard on which he had diagrammed where each item had been found in the pipe. Spiderwebs hung off the sides of the helmet. Sweat was running down his face and staining the painter's breathing mask he wore over his mouth and nose. Bosch held up the bag containing the shooter's kit. Donovan stopped in his tracks. "You find a stove in there?" Bosch asked.
"Shit, he's a hype," Donovan said. "I knew it. What the fuck are we doing all this for?"
Bosch didn't answer. He waited him out.
"Answer is, yes, I found a Coke can," Donovan said.
The crime scene tech looked through the plastic bags in his hands and held one up to Bosch. It contained two halves of a Coke can. The can looked reasonably new and had been cut in half with a knife. The bottom half had been inverted and its concave surface used as a pan to cook heroin and water. A stove. Most hypes no longer used spoons. Carrying a spoon was probable cause for arrest. Cans were easy to come by, easy to handle, and disposable. "We need the kit and the stove printed as soon as we can," Bosch said. Donovan nodded and carried his burden of plastic bags toward the police van. Bosch turned his attention back to the ME's men. "No knife on him, right?" Bosch said.
"Right," Sakai said.
"Why?" "I need a knife. Incomplete scene without a knife."
"So what? Guy's a hype. Hypes steal from hypes. His pals probably took it."
Sakai's gloved hands rolled up the sleeves of the dead man's shirt. This revealed a network of scar tissue on both arms. Old needle marks, craters left by abscesses and infections. In the crook of the left elbow was a fresh spike mark and a large, yellow and purplish hemorrhage under the skin.
"Bingo,"
Sakai said.
"I'd say this guy took a hot load in the arm and that was it. Like I said, you got a hype case, Bosch. You'll have an early day. Go get a Dodger dog."
Bosch crouched down again to look closer.
"Yeah, that's what everybody keeps telling me," he said.
And Sakai was probably right, he thought. But he didn't want to fool this one away yet. Too many things didn't fit. The missing tracks in the pipe, the shirt pulled over the head, the broken finger, no knife.
"How come all the tracks are old except the one?" he asked, more of himself than Sakai.
"Who knows?"
Sakai answered anyway.
"Maybe he'd been off it a while and decided to jump back in.
He's a hype's a hype. There aren't any reasons."
Staring at the tracks on the dead man's arms, Bosch noticed blue ink on the skin just below the sleeve that was bunched up on the left bicep. He couldn't see enough to make out what it said.
"Pull that up," he said, and pointed.
Sakai worked the sleeve up to the shoulder, revealing a tattoo of blue and red ink. It was a cartoonish rat standing on hind legs with a rabid, toothy, and vulgar grin. In one hand, the rat held a pistol, in the other a booze bottle marked XXX. The blue writing above and below the cartoon was smeared by age and the spread of skin. Sakai tried to read it.
"Says, four, no, first, says, first infantry. This guy was army. The bottom part doesn't make, that's another language. Non, gradum, anum, ro, I can't make that out."
"Rodentum," Bosch said. Sakai looked at him. "Dog Latin," Bosch told him. "Not worth a rat's ass. He was a tunnel rat. Vietnam."
"Whatever,"
Sakai said. He took an appraising look at the body and the pipe. He said,
"Well, he ended up in a tunnel, didn't he?" "Sort of."
Bosch reached his bare hand to the dead man's face and pushed the straggly black and gray hairs off the forehead and away from the vacant eyes. His doing this without gloves made the others stop what they were doing and watch this unusual, if not unsanitary, behavior. Bosch paid no notice.
He stared at the face for a long moment, not saying anything, not hearing if anything was said. In the moment that he realized that he knew the face, just as he knew the tattoo, the vision of a young man flashed in his mind. Raw-boned and tan, hair buzzed short, alive, not dead. He stood up and turned quickly away from the body. Making such a quick, unexpected motion, he banged straight into Jerry Edgar, who had finally arrived and walked up to huddle over the body. They both took a step back, momentarily stunned. Bosch put a hand to his forehead. Edgar, who was much taller, did the same to his chin.
"Oh, shit, Harry," Edgar said. "You all right?"
"Yeah, you?" Edgar checked his hand for blood.
"Yeah. Sorry about that. What are you jumping up like that for?"
"I don't know." Edgar looked over Harry's shoulder at the body and then followed his partner away from the pack.
"Yeah, sorry, Harry," Edgar said. "I sat there waiting an hour till somebody came out to cover me on my appointments. So tell me, what have we got?"
Edgar was still rubbing his jaw as he spoke.
"Not sure yet," Bosch said. "I want you to get in one of those patrol cars that has an MCT in it, one that works. See if you can get a sheet on a Meadows, Billy, make that William. DOB would be about 1950. We need to get an address from DMV.
"That's the stiff?"
Bosch nodded.
"Nothing? No address with his ID?"
"There is no ID. I made him. So check it out on the box. There should be some contact in the last few years, hype stuff at least, out of Van Nuys' division."
Edgar sauntered off toward the line of parked black and whites to find one with a mobile computer terminal mounted on the dashboard. Because he was a big man, his gait seemed slow, but Bosch knew from experience that Edgar was a hard man to keep pace with. Edgar was impeccably tailored in a brown suit with a thin chalk line. His hair was close-cropped, and his skin was almost as smooth and as black as an eggplant's. Bosch watched Edgar walk away, and couldn't help but wonder if he had timed his arrival to be just late enough to avoid having to wrinkle his ensemble by stepping into a jumpsuit and crawling into the pipe. Bosch went to the trunk of his car and got out the Polaroid camera. He then went back to the body, straddled it, and stooped to take photographs of the face. Three would be enough, he decided, and he placed each card that was ejected from the camera on top of the pipe while the photo developed. He couldn't help but stare at the face, at the changes made by time. He thought of that face and the inebriated grin that creased it on the night that all of the first infantry rats had come out of the tattoo parlor in Saigon. It had taken the burned-out Americans 4 hours, but they had all been made blood brothers by putting the same brand on their shoulders. Bosch remembered Meadows' joy in the companionship and fear they all shared. Harry stepped away from the body while Sakai and Osito unfolded a black, heavy plastic bag with a zipper running up the center. Once the body bag was unfolded and opened, the coroner's men lifted Meadows and placed him inside.
"Looks like Rip Van fucking Winkle," Edgar said as he walked up.
Sakai zipped the bag up, and Bosch saw a few of Meadows' curling gray hairs had been caught in the zipper. Meadows wouldn't mind. He had once told Bosch that he was destined for the inside of a body bag. He said everybody was. Edgar held a small notepad in one hand, a gold cross pen in the other.
"William Joseph Meadows, 72150. That sound like him, Harry?"
"Yeah, that's him."
"Well, you were right. We have multiple contacts, but not just hype shit. We got bank robbery, attempted robbery, possession of heroin. We got a loitering right here at the dam a year or so ago. And he did have a couple hype beefs. The one in Van Nuys you were talking about. What was he to you, a CI?"
"No." "Get an address?"
"Lives up in the valley, Sepulveda, up by the brewery. Tough neighborhood to sell a house in. So if he wasn't an informant, how'd you know this guy?"
"I didn't know him. At least recently. I knew him in a different life."
"What does that mean? When did you know the guy?"
"Last time I saw Billy Meadows was 20 years ago, or thereabouts. He was in Saigon."
"Yeah, that'd make it about 20 years.
Edgar walked over to the Polaroids and looked down at the three faces of Billy Meadows.
"You know him good?"
"Not really.
About as well as anybody got to know somebody there. You learn to trust people with your life, then when it's over, you realize you didn't really even know most of them. I never saw him once I got back here. Talked to him once on the phone last year, that's all. How'd you make him? I didn't at first. Then I saw the tattoo on his arm. That brought the face back. I guess you remember guys like him. I do, at least.
I guess.
They let the silence sit there a while. Bosch was trying to decide what to do, but could only wonder about the coincidence of being called to a death scene to find Meadows. Edgar broke the reverie.
So you want to tell me what you got that looks hinky here? Donovan over there looks like he's getting ready to shit his pants, all the work you're putting him through.
Bosch told Edgar about the problems, the absence of distinguishable tracks in the pipe, the shirt pulled over the head, the broken finger, and that there was no knife.
No knife, his partner said.
Needed something to cut the can in half to make a stove, if the stove was his.
Well, could have brought the stove with him. Could have been that somebody went in there and took the knife after the guy was dead, if there was a knife.
Yeah, could have been. No tracks to tell us anything.
Well, we know from his sheet he was a blown-out junkie. Was he like that when you knew him?
To a degree, a user and seller.
Well, there you go, long-time addict. You can't predict what they're gonna do, when they're gonna get off the shit or on it. They're lost people, Harry.
He was off it, though. At least I thought he was. He's only got one fresh pop in his arm.
Harry, you said you hadn't seen the guy since Saigon. How do you know whether he was off or on?
I hadn't seen him, but I talked to him. He called me once, last year sometime, July or August, I think. He'd been pulled in on another track marks beef by the hype car up in Van Nuys. Somehow, maybe reading newspapers or something, it was about the same time as the Dollmaker thing, he knew I was a cop, and he calls me up at robbery-homicide. He calls me from Van Nuys jail and asks if I could help him out. He would have only done, what, 30 days in county, but he was bottomed out, he said. And he just said he couldn't do the time this time. Couldn't kick alone like that.
Bosch trailed off without finishing his story. After a long moment, Edgar prompted him.
And? Come on, Harry, what did you do?
And I believed him. I talked to the cop. I remember his name was Knuckles. Good name for a street cop, I thought. And then I called the VA up there in Sepulveda, and I got him into a program. Knuckles went along with it. He's a vet, too. He got the city attorney to ask the judge for diversion. So anyway, the VA outpatient clinic took Meadows in. I checked about 6 weeks later, and they said he'd completed, had kicked, and was doing okay. I mean, that's what they told me. Said he was in the second level of maintenance, talking to a shrink, group counseling. I never talked to Meadows after that first call. He never called again, and I didn't try to look him up.
Edgar referred to his pad. Bosch could see the page he was looking at was blank.
Look, Harry, Edgar said. That was still almost a year ago. A long time for a hype, right? Who knows? He could have fallen off the wagon and kicked 3 times since then. That's not our worry here. The question is, what do you want to do with what we have here? What do you want to do about today?
You believe in coincidence? Bosch asked.
I don't know.
There are no coincidences.
Harry, I don't know what you're talking about, but you know what I think? I don't see anything here that's screaming in my face. Guy crawls into the pipe. In the dark, maybe he can't see what he's doing. He puts too much juice in his arm and croaks. That's it. Maybe somebody else was with him and smeared the tracks going out. Took his knife, too. Could be 100 different...
Sometimes they don't scream, Jerry. That's the problem here. It's Sunday. Everybody wants to go home, play golf, sell houses, watch the ball game. Nobody cares one way or the other. Just going through the motions. Don't you see that that's what they are counting on?
Who is they, Harry?
Whoever did this? He shut up for a minute. He was convincing no one, and that almost included himself. Playing to Edgar's sense of dedication was wrong. He'd be off the job as soon as he put in 20. He'd then put a business card-sized ad in the union newsletter. LAPD retired, will cut commission for brother officers, and make $250,000 a year selling houses to cops or for cops in the San Fernando Valley or the Santa Clarita Valley or the
Antelope Valley or whatever valley the bulldozer's aimed at next.
Why go in the pipe? Bosch said then. You said he lived up in the valley, Sepulveda. Why come down here?
Harry, who knows? The guy was a junkie. Maybe his wife kicked him out. Maybe he croaked himself up there and his friends dragged his dead ass down here because they didn't want to be bothered with explaining it.
That's still a crime.
Yeah, that's a crime. But let me know when you find a DA that'll file it for you.
His kit looked clean. New. The other tracks on his arm look old. I don't think he was slamming again. Not regularly. Something isn't right.
Well, I don't know. You know, AIDS and everything, they're supposed to keep a clean kit.
Bosch looked at his partner as if he didn't know him.
Harry, listen to me. What I'm telling you is that he may have been your foxhole buddy 20 years ago, but he was a junkie this year. You'll never be able to explain every action he took. I don't know about the kit or the tracks, but I do know that this does not look like one we should bust our humps on. This is a 9-to-5er, weekends and holidays excluded.
Bosch gave up for the moment. I'm going up to Sepulveda, he said. Are you coming, or are you going back to your open house?
I do my job, Harry, Edgar said softly. Just because we don't agree on something doesn't mean I'm not going to do what I'm paid to do. It's never been that way, never will be. But if you don't like the way I do business, we'll go see 98 tomorrow morning and see about a switch.
Bosch was immediately sorry for the cheap shot, but didn't say so. He said,
okay, you go on up there, see if anybody's home. I'll meet you after I sign off on the scene.
Edgar walked over to the pipe and took one of the Polaroid photos of Meadows. He slipped it into his coat pocket, then walked down the access road toward his car without saying another word to Bosch. After Bosch took off his jumpsuit and folded it away in the trunk of his car, he watched Sakai and Osito slide the body roughly onto a stretcher and then into the back of a blue van. He started over, thinking about what would be the best way to get the autopsy done as a priority, meaning by at least the next day instead of 4 or 5 days later. He caught up with the coroner's tech as he was opening the driver's door.
We're out of here, Bosch.
Bosch put his hand on the door, holding it from opening enough for Sakai to climb in. Who's doing the cutting today?
On this one?
Nobody.
Come on, Sakai, who's on?
Sally, but he's not going near this one, Bosch.
Look, I just went through this with my partner, not you two, okay?
Bosch, you look. You listen. I've been working since 6 last night, and this is the 7th scene I've been to. We got drive-bys, floaters, a sex case. People are dying to meet us, Bosch. There is no rest for the weary, and that means no time for what you think might be a case. Listen to your partner for once. This one is going on the routine schedule. That means we'll get to it by Wednesday, maybe Thursday, I promise Friday at the latest. And tox results is at least a 10-day wait anyway. You know that. So what's your goddamn hurry?
Tox results are at least a 10-day wait.
Fuck off.
Just tell Sally I need the prelim done today. I'll be by later.
Christ, Bosch, listen to what I'm telling you. We've got bodies on gurneys stacked in the hall that we already know are 187s and need to be cut. Salazar is not going to have time for what looks to me and everybody else around here except you like a hype case. Cut and dried, man. What am I going to say to him that's going to make him do the cut today?
Show him the finger. Tell him there were no tracks in the pipe. Think of something. Tell him the DB was a guy who knew needles too well to have OD'd.
Sakai put his head back against the van's side panel and laughed loudly. Then he shook his head as if a child had made a joke.
And you know what he'll say to me? He'll say that it doesn't matter how long he'd been spiking, they all fuck up. Bosch, how many 65-year-old junkies do you see around? None of them go the distance. The needle gets them all in the end, just like this guy in the pipe.
Bosch turned and looked around to make sure none of the uniforms were watching and listening. Then he turned back to Sakai's face.
Just tell him I'll be by there later, he said quietly.
If he doesn't find anything on the prelim, then fine. You can stick the body at the end of the line in the hall, or you can park it down at the gas station on Lancashire.
I won't care then, Larry. But you tell him. It's his decision, not yours.
Bosch dropped his hand from the door and stepped back. Sakai got in the van and slammed the door. He started the engine and looked at Bosch through the window for a long moment before rolling it down.
Bosch, you're a pain in the ass. Tomorrow morning. It's the best I can do. Today is no way.
First cut of the day?
Just leave us alone today, okay?
First cut?
Yeah. First cut.
Sure, I'll leave you alone. See you tomorrow, then.
Not me, man. I'll be sleeping.
Sakai rolled the window back up, and the van moved away. Bosch stepped back to let it pass, and when it was gone, he was left staring at the pipe. It was really for the first time, then, that he noticed the graffiti. Not that he hadn't seen that the exterior of the pipe was literally covered with painted messages, but this time he looked at the individual scrawls. Many were old, faded together, a tableau of letters spelling threats either long forgotten or since made good. There were slogans, Abandon L.A. There were names, Ozone, Bomber, Striker, many others. One of the fresher tags caught his eye. It was just three letters about 12 feet from the end of the pipe.
Shah.
The three letters had been painted in one fluid motion. The top of the S was jagged and then contoured, giving the impression of a mouth, a gaping maw. There were no teeth, but Bosch could sense them. It was as though the work wasn't completed. Still, it was good work, original and clean. He aimed the Polaroid at it and took a photo. Bosch walked to the police van, putting the exposure in his pocket. Donovan was stowing his equipment on shelves and the evidence bags in wooden Napa Valley wine boxes. "Did you find any burned matches in there?"
"Yeah, one fresh one," Donovan said. "Burned to the end. It was about 10 feet in. It's there in the chart."
Bosch picked up a clipboard on which there was a piece of paper with a diagram of the pipe showing the body location and where the other material taken from the pipe had been. Bosch noticed that the match was found about 15 feet from the body. Donovan then showed him the match, sitting at the bottom of its own plastic evidence bag.
"I'll let you know if it matches the book in the guy's kit," he said, "if that's what you're thinking."
Bosch said, "What about the uniforms? What'd they find?"
"It's all there,"
Donovan said, pointing to a wooden bin in which there were still more plastic evidence bags. These contained debris picked up by patrol officers who had searched the area within a 50-yard radius of the pipe. Each bag contained a description of the location where the object had been found. Bosch took each bag out and examined its contents. Most of it was junk that would have nothing to do with the body and the pipe. There were newspapers, clothing rags, a high-heeled shoe, a white sock with dried blue paint in it, a sniff rag. Bosch picked up a bag containing the top to a can of spray paint. The next bag contained the spray paint can. The Krylon label said it was Ocean Blue. Bosch hefted the bag and could tell there was still paint in the can. He carried the bag to the pipe, opened it, and touching the nozzle with a pen, sprayed a line of blue next to the letters Shah. He sprayed too much. The paint ran down the curved side of the pipe and dripped onto the gravel. But Bosch could see the colors matched. He thought about that for a moment. Why would a graffiti tagger throw half a can of paint away? He looked at the writing on the evidence bag. It had been found near the edge of the reservoir. Someone had attempted to throw the can into the lake, but came up short. Again, he thought, why? He squatted next to the pipe and looked closely at the letters. He decided that whatever the message or name was, it wasn't finished. Something had happened that made the tagger stop what he was doing and throw the can, the top, and his sniff sock over the fence. Was it the police? Bosch took out his notebook and wrote a reminder to call Crowley after midnight to see if any of his people had cruised the reservoir during the AM watch. But what if it wasn't a cop that made the tagger throw the paint over the fence? What if the tagger had seen the body being delivered to the pipe? Bosch thought about what Crowley had said about an anonymous caller reporting the body, a kid, no less. Was it the tagger who called? Bosch took the can back to the SID truck and handed it to Donovan. "Print this after the kid in the stove," he said. "I think it might belong to a witness."
"Will do,"
Donovan said. Bosch drove down out of the hills and took the Barham Boulevard ramp onto the northbound Hollywood freeway. After coming up through the Cahuenga Pass,
He went west on the Ventura Freeway and then north again on the San Diego Freeway. It took about 20 minutes to go the 10 miles. It was Sunday and traffic was light. He exited on Roscoe and went east a couple of blocks into Meadows' neighborhood on Langdon. Sepulveda, like most of the suburban communities within Los Angeles, had both good and bad neighborhoods. Bosch wasn't expecting trimmed lawns and curbs lined with Volvos on Meadows' street, and he wasn't disappointed. The apartments were at least a decade past being attractive. There were bars over the windows of the bottom units and graffiti on every garage door. The sharp smell of the brewery on Roscoe wafted into the neighborhood. The place smelled like a 4 a.m. bar. Meadows had lived in a U-shaped apartment building that had been built in the 1950s, when the smell of hops wasn't yet in the air, gangbangers weren't on the street corner, and there was still hope in the neighborhood. There was a pool in the center courtyard, but it had long been filled in with sand and dirt. Now the courtyard consisted of a kidney-shaped plot of brown grass surrounded by dirty concrete. Meadows had lived in an upstairs corner apartment. Bosch could hear the steady drone of the freeway as he climbed the stairs and moved along the walkway that fronted the apartments. The door to 7B was unlocked, and it opened into a small living room, dining room, kitchen. Edgar was leaning against the counter writing in his notebook. He said, "Nice place, huh?" "Yeah," Bosch said and looked around. "Nobody home?"
"Nah. I checked with the neighbor next door, and she hadn't seen anybody around since the day before yesterday. Said the guy that lived here told her his name was Fields, not Meadows." "Cute, huh?" "She said he lived all by himself, been here about a year, kept to himself mostly, that's all she knew."
"You show her the picture?"
"Yeah, she made him. Didn't like looking at a picture of a dead guy, though."
Bosch walked into a short hallway that led to a bathroom and a bedroom. He said, "You picked the door?"
"Nah, it was unlocked." "No shit. I knock a couple times, and I'm fixing to get my pouch out of the car and finesse the lock when, for the hell of it, I try the door."
"And it opens?"
"It opens."
"You talk to the landlord?"
"Landlady's not around. Supposed to be, but maybe she went out to eat lunch or score some horse. I think everybody I've seen around here is a spiker."
Bosch came back into the living room and looked around.
There wasn't much.
A couch covered with green vinyl was pushed against one wall. A stuffed chair was against the opposite wall, with a small color television on the carpet next to it. There was a Formica-topped table with three chairs around it in the dining room. The fourth chair was by itself against the wall. Bosch looked at an old, cigarette-scarred coffee table in front of the couch. On it were an overloaded ashtray and a crossword puzzle book. Playing cards were laid out in an unfinished game of solitaire. There was a TV guide. Bosch had no idea if Meadows smoked, but he knew that no cigarettes had been found on the body. He made a mental note to check on it later.
Edgar said, "Harry, this place was turned. Not just the door being open and all, but, I mean, there are other things. The whole place has been searched. They did a halfway decent job, but you can tell. It was rushed. Go check out the bed in the closet, you'll see what I mean. I'm going to get landlady another try."
Edgar left, and Bosch walked back through the living room to the bedroom. Along the way, he noted the smell of urine. In the bedroom, he found a queen-sized bed without a backboard, pushed against one wall. There was a greasy discoloration on the white wall at about the level where Meadows would have leaned his head while sitting up in bed. Opposite the bed was an old six-drawer dresser against the wall. A cheap rattan night table with a lamp on it stood next to the bed. Nothing else was in the room, not even a mirror. Bosch studied the bed first. It was unmade, with pillows and sheets in a pile in the center. Bosch noticed that a corner of one of the sheets was folded between the mattress and the box spring, in the midsection of the left side of the bed. The bed would not have been made that way, obviously. Bosch pulled the corner out from under the mattress and let it hang loosely off the side of the bed. He lifted the mattress as if to search underneath it, then lowered it back into place. The corner of the sheet was back between the mattress and the box spring. Edgar was right. He next opened the six bureau drawers. What clothes there were, underwear, white and dark socks, and several T-shirts, were neatly folded and seemed undisturbed. When he closed the bottom left drawer, he noticed that it slid unevenly and would not close all the way. He pulled it all the way out of the bureau.
Then he pulled another drawer completely out of the dresser, then the rest. When he had all the drawers out, he checked the underside of each to see if something was or had been taped to it. He found nothing. He put them back in, but kept changing their order until each one slid easily into place and closed.